content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. Well, today's program, we will complete the article we began last time, titled An American Tale by Jake Whitney. When a Japanese family was sent to an internment camp in 1942, one neighbor quietly risked everything to look after their farm and their future. So we had the Tsukamoto family, who was placed in the internment camp. They started in Fresno, and then were moved to the Jerome Internment Center in Arkansas, but they had their neighbor, Bob Fletcher, who was basically a hero and took care of the camps and wasn't concerned about the money, but wanted to make sure that the families had something when they came back. So now we'll pick up where we left off last time. When I told my family and friends that I was researching Japanese-American internment, many asked a version of the same question. Why didn't America lock up Germans and Italians? In fact, some people of German and Italian ancestry were locked in camps overseen by the Justice Department. However, only first-generation immigrants were targeted, not their American-born children or naturalized citizens, and only a fraction of those. The total number of interned Germans and Italians was around 14,500. While this number is minuscule, compared with the 125,284 Japanese incarcerees, racism does not appear to have been the only factor behind the difference. As Susan H. Kamai points out in her book, When Can We Go Back to America? Germans and Italians were the two largest foreign-born populations in America at the time. There were 1.2 million German-born Americans and more than 5 million Americans who had two German-born parents. There were even more Italians. Their sheer numbers meant the mass internment would have been a logistical nightmare. And unlike Japanese and Chinese immigrants, Germans and Italians were allowed to become American citizens, which meant that they made up an enormous voting bloc. Neither politicians nor military leaders wanted to risk alienating them. According to Marielle, the youngest of the Tsukamoto family, her family arrived at Jerome in Arkansas. Her father and other adults volunteered to work with farmers near the camp for free, but the farmers refused. Later, after Jerome became a holding camp for German POWs, these same farmers accepted help from German soldiers and not only paid them, but in some cases, allowed them to live in their homes. At the same time, thousands of American citizens of Japanese ancestry had been serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, some 5,000 at the time of Pearl Harbor. In January 1942, all Japanese Americans were classified as enemy aliens ineligible for the draft. Soldiers of Japanese descent were discharged. In January 1943, the U.S. government announced that Nisei would be allowed to enlist in the army again. An all-Nisei combat unit was being assembled, and the military was recruiting from the camps. Nisei are second-born generations. While many incarcerees met the news with excitement, Al Tsukamoto wanted to enlist but couldn't because of his pleurisy. It resulted in confusion and contention. Incarcerees at all the camps over age 17, even those who didn't plan to enlist, were forced to fill out a loyalty oath, and two of the questions were often misinterpreted. One asked if the internee was prepared to fight for the United States wherever ordered. The other asked if they would swear unqualified allegiance to the United States and disavow any allegiance to Japan. As Marielle put it, if you're 80 years old and asked, are you willing to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces wherever ordered, what are you supposed to say? About 12% of incarcerees answered no to the unqualified allegiance question or gave a qualified yes. This created paranoia and suspicion between incarcerees and authorities, and also among the incarcerees themselves. In some cases, incarcerees did, in fact, remain loyal to Japan in some capacity. The emotional struggle was a great one, Mary wrote. Many of us were on the verge of mental breakdowns. The pressures and lack of privacy weighed so heavily on Mary's sister, Jean, that she had to be institutionalized. The late winter of 1943 was the most difficult period for the Tsukamotos. The cold brought depression, the loyalty questionnaire brought division, and a number of friends and extended family members died or became ill. Mary and Al worried about the toll the camp life was taking on Mariel's development. "We were down at the bottom of the pit," Mary later said. By spring 1943, however, things began to look up. The War Relocation Authority decided to allow incarcerees who were deemed loyal Americans to find jobs beyond the camp. For those who did not get jobs, trips outside the camp were occasionally allowed. Mary, for example, was permitted to take the bus ride to Jackson, Mississippi to attend a YWCA leadership conference. In the fall, the government began allowing incarcerees to leave the camp for good, though they still weren't allowed to return to the West Coast. Al was happy to leave in September for a job prospect in Chicago. Unhappy there, he moved on to Kalamazoo, Michigan. He landed a job at the Peter Pan Bakery, whose owner was hiring workers from the camps. In November, Mary and Marielle were allowed to leave Jerome to join Al in Kalamazoo. "We got off the train and Al came running to meet us," Mary wrote. Happiness sometimes defies description. Our new life in Kalamazoo had begun. By the spring of 1944, Mary's father, brother, and sister Julia all joined Al at the bakery. Al seemed to enjoy the work. In his JACL interview, he boasts about his cake-making prowess, but the owner insisted that Japanese Americans work night shifts so no customers would see them. Julia found it humiliating to be hidden from customers, so she asked for and was granted a day job. When a customer spotted her and lodged a boycott, she was sent back to night shifts. This had a profound effect on Julia, who had long suffered from depression. She later took her own life. While the family was in Kalamazoo, Bob Fletcher wrote with the sad news that Uppy, the family dog, had run away only a few months after the Tsukamotos departed. Marielle was devastated, assuming that Uppy had gone searching for them. But Fletcher had good news, too. The price of grapes was soaring, so the families would have savings when they returned. On December 17, 1944, President Roosevelt revoked the West Coast Exclusion Order, allowing Japanese Americans to go back to their homes there. Some returned home immediately, only to face vigilantes and violent confrontations. "Going home turned into a frightening mistake for them," Mary wrote later. The Tsukamotos finally set out for Florin in the summer of 1945. Al arranged to acquire a green 42 Dodge from white friends back home, which they used for the return trip. They got 7 flat tires along the way. As a rule, they followed the most direct route and avoided stopping for fear of confrontations. As Mary later wrote in her book, even if that meant traveling over the high mountains along dangerous cliffs. They did, however, stop to give rides to American servicemen. Mary believed it was their patriotic duty as good American citizens. This became impossible, however, after they stopped in Gila, Arizona, to pick up Al's sister's Edith's family, the Ochitas. The Dodge was crammed with 7 people and their belongings, along with Marielle's new dog, a Scotty named Inky. The family finally reached town before dawn on July 10, 1945. They had been gone for 3 years and 42 days. But their happy homecoming was tempered by the town's shocking appearance. Businesses boarded up, cars and tractors stripped of parts, houses burned to the ground. The one-time strawberry capital of the world looked like a ghost town. The Tsukamotos dropped off the Ochitas and headed toward their farm. Kuzo Ito and Nami, along with Mary's parents and her sister Jean, would later return to Florin by train. When Al turned onto their street, he cut the headlights to avoid attracting attention. Pulling into their driveway, no one spoke. The main house out front, the barn leaning against the walnut trees, and the 2 old cabins by the bathhouse all appeared as they had when the family was forced out in May 1942. Al, Mary, and Marielle each got out of the car and raced around the farm, touching things to make sure they were real. Then Marielle told me they entered their house to find Bob and Teresa Fletcher waiting, with smiles, hugs, and a meal on the table. "They were just so welcoming," Marielle said. In a rare emotive passage in his journal, Fletcher expressed pride in what he did for the Japanese American farmers. I was always glad when the families came home in 1945 and found their ranches in fairly good shape, which wasn't the case for many of the families that returned. Indeed, the Sukamotos were among the lucky ones. Vandalism, theft, and mismanagement were widespread in Florin. In Mary's JACL interview, she spoke about the irresponsible tenants that FFGA had hired to oversee local farms. Many hadn't even paid the taxes, she said. They'd use the family's tractor and ruin it. The grapevines were half dead because they hadn't watered them enough. One Florin farmer named George Miao had his truck stolen and tractor stripped of parts. In a JACL interview, Miao spoke of another family whose tenant refused to leave the house upon their return. After the family kicked him out, he burned their house down. Percy Nakashima had had a friend whose supposed caretaker sold the ranch at the first opportunity and kept the money. Incidents like these were common across the West Coast. One high-profile case involved Mary Masuda, who had been interned in Gila, Arizona. Masuda returned to her family in Orange County, California, to find squatters. The native sons of the Golden West, who are notoriously anti-Japanese, swooped in to defend the squatters and warned her to leave the county immediately. Unafraid, Masuda contacted the press and moved back into her house. Her story attracted widespread sympathy because it turned out that Masuda's oldest brother, Kazuo, had been killed while fighting with the 442nd Infantry Regiment, an all-Nisei combat unit who had become one of the most decorated regiments in American history. Of more than 90,000 Japanese Americans from California who were incarcerated in internment camps, most would never return to farming. Total losses to Japanese American property and income may have been as high as $4 billion. Richard Reeves, in Infamy, cites a government estimate that West Coast Japanese Americans lost 75% of their assets. So where did the people go? Some remained where they had gotten jobs back east. Margaret, her husband, and their seven children stayed behind in Michigan, and the Sukamotos considered staying there as well. Others moved to cities that had emptied of white workers during the war. Before the war, only a few thousand Japanese Americans lived east of the Rocky Mountains. Afterward, more Nisei moved primarily to seven states: Illinois, Colorado, Ohio, Idaho, Michigan, Minnesota, and New York. In Florin, where 2,500 Japanese residents had been incarcerated, the strawberry industry would never return to its golden years. Many returning Florinites sold their farms immediately or worked them a few more years before selling. Percy Nakashima switched to tomato farming. When this didn't work out, he got a job with Del Monte Foods in Sacramento. George Miao sold his farm in 1952, but stayed in Florin to work as a gardener. Harold Ochida moved to New Jersey to work for the Birdseye Frozen Food Company. According to Mary, Birdseye actively recruited Japanese-American former farmers because of their skill in handling vegetables. But for many former incarcerees, it was difficult to get back on their feet. Mary wrote of Florinites living in barns or shacks and working menial jobs to survive. Reeves described how many destitute Japanese were forced to live in shoddy towns, trailer parks, and abandoned army barracks after the war. And then there were the Issei who resisted going home at all, afraid of white people, angry with America. Some died by suicide, some returned to Japan. Al and Mary decided to tear out the grapevines that Kuzo planted all those years ago. They sold the farm in 1949, and Mary got a job as a teacher in the Elk Grove Unified School District, while Al worked for the Sacramento Army Department repairing communications equipment. Mariel, meanwhile, thrived outside the camps. In grade school, she was a Girl Scout and sang in the church choir. The family were Methodists. In high school, she was a radio reporter, student body secretary, and officer of various clubs. She attended the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, and followed in her mother's footsteps by embarking upon a distinguished teaching career. In the 1980s, Congress established the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, which concluded that internment had been a grave injustice born out of racial prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. Just 10 people had been convicted of spying for Japan, and all had been white. Mary Sukamoto was the driving force behind the redress movement. Upon retiring as a teacher in 1976 after 26 years, she was executive secretary of the Florin JACL Redress Committee. In 1981, she testified before a House subcommittee hearing in San Francisco. "My life was never the same," Mary wrote after speaking at the hearing. "The urgency of my bold commitment took precedence over everything else in the days that were left for me on this earth." In 1983, Mary launched the Time of Remembrance program for the Elk Grove Unified School District, which brought together students and former incarcerees. She also created the Japanese American Archival Collection at California State University. In 1987, the year before she published her book, she helped the Smithsonian curate artifacts for an internment exhibition titled A More Perfect Union. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, which provided $20,000 in redress to each camp survivor. Mary and Al were at the White House for the signing, and Mary went on to receive a National Humanitarian Award. An elementary school in the Elk Grove District was named after her, and she was among the first two people honored as notable Californian by the California State Senate. In her JACL interview and in her book, Mary repeatedly expressed gratitude to Bob Fletcher. She called him one in a million and our faithful friend. For their part, after the Tsukamotos returned, Bob and Teresa bought a 54-acre ranch on which they raised cattle and hay. Their marriage was a happy one by all accounts. Stauer said that Teresa complimented Bob's stoicism with her gregarious personality. She was a jokester, and her grandpa mellowed out as he aged. Unsurprisingly, Fletcher kept busy after the war. He helped create the Florin Fire Protection District in 1953, where he served as chief for 12 years. In 1959, he helped found the Florin County Water District to protect the water rights of local farmers. In 1985, he was involved in creating the Florin Historical Society, where he served as president and board member. In 1996, Mary said of Fletcher, "He's still our best friend, and he's still alive, so we're very happy we can tell him that over and over again," Fletcher said. "I don't think there's anyone I like better than Mary." 3 weeks after Mary died in 1988, U.S. Congressman Robert Matsui paid tribute to her on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. He honored her personal strength and determination in pursuing justice and promoting the heritage of all Japanese Americans. He added, "Her impact on our national heritage and the very fabric of who we are as a country would be felt for many generations to come." In 2011, Matsui's wife, Doris, who succeeded him in office, had the opportunity to honor Fletcher on the House floor, saluting his decades of civil service and his ability to look past racial barriers and help save the farms of three Japanese-American families. On a blustery morning this past February, Mariel Tsukamoto, who now lives in Elk Grove, about 10 miles south of Florin, stood in the lobby of Sacramento's California Museum, waiting for a group of fifth graders. She was there to act as a docent for an exhibition called Uprooted, which tells the story of Japanese-American internment. The students were from Florin Elementary, and their teacher had assigned them to read about Mariel and watch all the interviews with her he could find online. When they spotted her, they treated her like a celebrity. "There she is," one girl yelled, giggling and jumping. "Can I take your picture?" another shouted. The students were a diverse group from a low-income area, and Mariel happily posed for selfies. With curly brown hair and glasses, she was dressed in a black jacket over a pink turtleneck with a Polynesian sun necklace. Not even 5 feet tall, she was about the same height as most of the students. She was astonishingly energetic, and her commentary held the students rapt. The show included an interactive display where visitors could ask questions of Mariel and other former incarcerees, bringing up videos of pre-recorded answers. It also included a life-size replica of a camp apartment. The apartment was bare bones. They were typically 20 by 25 feet and held as many as 8 people, with a chamber pot between the beds. Mariel paused in front of a large black-and-white photograph of Bob Fletcher standing in a field, part of a display honoring non-Japanese Americans who helped interned families. He wore a floppy cap and a suede jacket, surrounded by wooden posts and vines. Before Fletcher died in 2013, at age 101, he donated 5 acres of his land to the town of Florin. On that land now sits a park as well as the Fletcher Farm Community Center, which displays old artifacts from Florin. including items related to internment, and host community meetings and events. That afternoon, Marielle and I visited the center and drove past Bob and Teresa's old home, a modest ranch. Other stops included the Florin Buddhist Church, built in 1919, as well as the original location of the Florin Japanese Methodist Church from around the same time. During the internment years, both buildings were used to store possessions of Japanese-American families who'd been sent away. But Florin, like almost everywhere else in America, has been highly developed since the 1940s. Its main drag is crammed with housing complexes, strip malls, gas stations, and two used car dealerships. When Marielle recognized an area where a piece of her family's farmland had been, it was a parking lot belonging to an industrial company. There were several stretches that remained flat and green enough that I could imagine old Florin. I thought of what Kuzo might have seen when he first arrived here. Early settlers, awestruck by the area's wildflowers, named the town after the Latin word for flower. The region's beauty may have played a role in Kuzo's decision to settle here. It was the American dream come true, until it wasn't. I also thought of Bob Fletcher, toiling in the vineyards. He had quit his job, lost a wife, made enemies, and worked 18 hours a day to keep up. Once during the Tsukamoto's incarceration, he received a letter from Mary that read, "We should be the ones to send you courage and strength and cheer as you undertake this great struggle. Sometimes it's hard to write a cheerful letter because we get so self-centered here. But it isn't very bad. Much depends on our attitudes. I think we are strong enough to take it." One can imagine Fletcher reading Mary's words of resolve and vowing to stay the course, no matter the duration, no matter the difficulties. If Mary could take it, and Al and Mary Ellen Kuzo and Ito and George Miao and Percy Nakashima and tens of thousands of other Japanese Americans unjustly incarcerated, then he sure as hell could too. As Marielle told the schoolchildren that day, Fletcher was an honorable American who deserved recognition even though he didn't seek it. When people asked him why he helped us, he always said, "Oh, I didn't do anything special. It was just the right thing to do." Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section by Ashley Brown, titled "A Most Miraculous Mold: The True, Forgotten, and Sometimes Stinky History of the Penicillin Girls." For many people, a bloom of mold symbolizes failure. But this small medallion of mold, its two dots of Penicillium notatum, blossoming like fungal flowers frozen in eternal spring, represents an astounding success. It's the mycelial spark that touched off an antibiotic revolution. Scottish bacteriologist Alexander Fleming recognized the potential of Penicillium mold when he found it growing in his less-than-tidy lab at St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London in 1928. While experimenting on the disease-causing Staphylococcus aureus bacterium, the sharp-eyed Fleming noticed protective halos around some of the flecks of the blue-green mold, which were inhabiting the bacteria's growth. He first colorfully dubbed the substance mold juice, later changing it to penicillin, after the fungus that produced it. Fleming announced his discovery, infection-fighting potential, to little fanfare, and then, with the help of two young researchers, tried purifying penicillin in the 1930s, but he was unsuccessful. Today, Fleming is often remembered as the lone genius in the lab who, thanks to keen eyes and a strange accident, brought penicillin to the world. In fact, to unlock mold's true therapeutic promise would take many more people, years of labor, a war, and a very special moldy cantaloupe. Around a decade after the Scottish microbiologist's chance discovery, University of Oxford team picked up Fleming's work on penicillin, just as Europe was on the brink of another world war. By 1940, the Oxford team, guided by Howard Florey, Ernst Chain, and Norman Hartley, managed to isolate and purify enough penicillin to save four lives, a major medical breakthrough even though the lives belonged to mice. Producing enough penicillin to save human lives would not prove simple. Fleming's Penicillium preferred growing on the surface of a nutrient-rich liquid, or mold broth, as Fleming dubbed it, and even with vast volumes of broth, produced scant amounts of the antibiotic. The Oxford lab got creative in finding more surface area in which to cultivate the mold, growing it practically everywhere, from bedpans to bathtubs. Eventually, the team developed a special fermentation container that looked like a bit like a vintage gasoline can, with a side spout for pouring. surrounded by dozens of these ceramic fermentation vessels in a kind of mold factory, six female technicians known as the Penicillin Girls carefully cultivated the Oxford team's prized penicillin supply, pumping out a few milligrams each week for experiments and clinical trials. From there, they have to separate the tiny bit of actual penicillin they're going to get from all that. It's like making maple syrup, says Diane Wendt, a curator in the Division of Medicine and Science at the Smithsonian Museum's National Museum of American History. But even these moves couldn't produce life-saving amounts of antibiotic. And with Nazi Germany's blitz on London appareling UK-based research, in 1941, Florey and Heatley carried Fleming's mold to the United States, hoping to create higher yields on safer ground. Their unlikely journey brought them to Peoria, Illinois, in a U.S. Department of Agriculture laboratory fit for cutting-edge fermentation experiments. One key discovery at the lab was to cultivate the mold more efficiently by sinking it into deep tanks of starchy brew. Still, Fleming's mold wasn't growing bountifully in these new conditions. The USDA team needed to explore together more productive strains and species of penicillium mold. So they gathered members of the U.S. Army Transportation Corps, along with researchers and laypeople, to begin searching for new mold specimens and stacks of spoiled bread, cheese, meats, and produce, and scanning the rich microbiota of soils for as far as Australia and India. By 1943, someone finally did strike gold with the most productive penicillin mold from a musty melon, a mysterious woman history has nicknamed Moldy Mary. Confusingly, while one technician at the Peoria lab, Mary Hunt, also bore this nickname, in fact, the true Moldy Mary was probably an anonymous Peoria woman who handed an old cantaloupe to a lab guard in one of history's most underrated gifts. What's certain, thanks to a funky cantaloupe's exceptional ability to produce penicillin, six times the amount of Fleming's mold, the mass production of antibiotics was finally possible. Penicillin has saved more than 80 million lives. In 1945, Fleming, Florey, and Chain received the Nobel Prize for contributions to penicillin's discovery and applications. Then in 1953, a curator at Smithsonian wrote to Fleming, asking him to donate materials from his lab for an exhibition. The microbiologist sent a commemorative culture he prepared from the original penicillium mold. This 2-inch sample was grown on blotting paper and sealed behind rounded glass. In early 2025, the symbolic dried mold will return to display as part of the medical history exhibition, Do No Harm, a reminder that history's great discoveries can come from the most unprepossessing places. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.